He keeps waking with his heart racing, fear in his bowels, something loud having just occurred, waiting for it to repeat. And as he relaxes, never knowing the precise moment it begins, the infernal deedly, 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 dee again. The Rebel Weaver was set in the Golden Valley, being a light-hearted account of the late battles there between weavers and clothiers, with interludes of music, juggling, and tricksome animal life. Strangely, Mason has reported to Dixon, I was not appalled, though I've every reason to be. The plot, about a weaver's son who loves the daughter of a clothier, and the conflict of loyalties resulting, presents nothing more troubling sentimentally than the comic misunderstandings of an Italian opera. One or two of the slower tunes, lugubrious to some ears, he even yet fancies, though this damn gallop is another matter. Upon his own side of the bed, Dixon snores in a versatility of tone that Mason, were he less anxious about getting to sleep, might be taking notes upon, perhaps to be written up and submitted to the Philosophical Transactions, so unexpectedly polyphonic do some passages emerge, all at the same unhurried, yet presently infuriating, andante. Both men lie in the clothing they have worn all day, Dixon as faithful to field surveyor's custom as Mason to that of the stargazer, his quotidian dress at Greenwich having ever doubled as his observing suit. To sleep, one simply took off the coat, though Dixon has advised against this here. He is, of course, right. The bugs run free. American bugs, who so much resent being brushed off human surfaces that they will bite anyone for even approaching. That's it, then. Himself a giant bug, he rolls quietly from under the counterpane and crawls from the room, dresses in the hallway and upon the stairs, and is soon insensibly translated into the Orchid Tavern by Doc Creek, hat beside him, cue a snarl, buying too many rounds, enjoying viciously as any recreational traveler the quaint stridencies of a politics not his own, yet before intoxication sets in, continuing to seek, somewhere in the perilous text of faction, insult, and threat, a line or two of worth to take home with him. Pennsylvania politics? Its name is simplicity. Religious bodies here cannot be distinguished from political factions. These are Quaker, Anglican, Presbyterian, German Pietist. Each prevails in its own area of the province. Till about 5 years ago, the Presbyterians fought among themselves so fiercely that despite their great numbers, they remained without much political effect. Lately, since the old and new lights reached their accommodation, all the other parties have hastened to strike bargains with them as they may. Not least of these, the Penns, who, though Quaker by ancestry, are Anglican in praxis. Some even say tools of Rome. Mr. Shippen, upon whom you must wait for each penny you'll spend, is a Presbyterian, the city variety, quite at ease as a member of the Governor's Council. As for the Anglicans of Philadelphia, the periodic arrival in town of traveling ministries such as the Reverend McClenahan's have now split those folk between traditional Pennites and reborns adazzle with the new light, who are more than ready to throw in with the Presbyterians against the Quakers, though so far Quakers have been able to act in the assembly as a body and prevail. Not sure I'm following this, Mason says. May you never have the need, sir. 'Tis useful nonetheless, now and then, to regard politics here as the greater American question in miniature, in the way that chess represents war, with Governor Penn a game piece in the form of the king. Who'd be the Rockingham Whigs, I wonder? At a short arpeggio from the clavier, a voice through the vapors announces, The moment now ye've all been waiting for. The saloon of the Orchid Tavern is pleased to present the famed Leyden Jar Danse Macabre, with that Euclid of the Electric, Philadelphia's own Poor Richard in the part of Death. Eager applause as into the lantern light comes a hooded, scythe-bearing figure in skeleton's disguise. Though the instant it begins to speak, all sinister impression is compromised. Ah, excellent. Now, if I might have a few volunteers from what obviously here tonight is the flower of Philadelphian youth. Behold, pilgrims of prodigy, my new battery, 24 jars crackling and ready. Dr. Franklin, now throwing back his hood to reveal lenses tonight of a curious shade of aquamarine, allowing his eyes to be viewed, yet conveying a bleak contentment that discourages lengthy gazing. Come, gentlemen, who'll be next? That's it. Good. Line of fops, all hold hands. Line of fops, how many have we now? Dear me, not enough. Come one more, ever room for one more. Thus, briskly collecting into line a dozen or so heedless continentals, placing into the hands of the hindmost a copper cable from one terminal of the battery, and grasping the hand of the frontmost, Franklin reaches with the blade of his scythe to touch the other terminal, the landlord at the same instant dousing the glim, so that the resulting tableau is lit by terrifying stark flashes of blue-white light amidst the harsh sputter of the fulminous fluid and the giggling and indeed screaming of the participants, snuff flying everywhere and now and then igniting in billows of green flame amid infernal columns of smoke. The battery having discharged, light is restored, the company presently regaining enough composure to note the arrival of a thunder gust as windows begin to rattle and trees to creak, and the landlord rushes about trying to draw the curtains, as thereby the hearty opposition of these electrophiles, whose wish is ever to observe their admired fluid in its least mediated form. "So much for Harlequin," cries Dr. Franklin. "Let us get out into the night's main drama. There's weather gear for all. This scythe here is the perfect shape to catch us a bolt, perhaps a good many. Better than a key upon a kite, indeed. Think of it as death's picklock. Come, form your line. All here?" Pulling his hood up again, felonious entry into the anterooms of the Creator. "Not joining us tonight, Mr. Mason?" Lowering his lenses and staring for an instant. Before Mason, from whom all comfort has flown, can quite reply, the figure has turned and taken a hand at the end of the line. The door opens and the wind and rain blow in. Thunder crashes, and with odd, strangled cries of amusement, the party of seekers are plunged out into the storm and vanished. Chapter 30. Upon the day appointed, pursuant to the Chancery decision, the commissioners of both provinces, with remembrancers and correspondents, attended by a thronglet of children out of school, sailors, Irishmen, and other citizens exempt from or disobedient to the humorless rule of clock time here, all go trooping down to Cedar Street and the house in question to establish its north wall officially as the southernmost point of Philadelphia. 15 miles south of this, to the width of a red pubic hair, or RPH, will the west line run. The neighbors gather and mutter. "Well, ye would think they'd wait a bit. 80 years, that isn't enough. Way this town's growing, that south point'll be across the street and down the block before the week's out. Aye, moving even as we speak, hard to detain as a greased pig." The sector is borne in a padded wagon, like some mechanical odalisque. Children jump, flapping their arms in unconscious memory of when they had wings, to see inside. "Why not use the south wall?" inquire several of them, far too pert for their sizes and ages. "The south wall lies within private property," replies the mayor's assistant. "So as the southernmost public surface, the parties have agreed upon this north wall here, facing the street." Mr. Benjamin Loxley and his crew have been busily erecting an observatory in a vacant piece nearby. Mid the mixed rhythms of hammers, each framer had his own slightly different tempo and blurted phrases of songs. "Done many of these, Ben?" "First one, but don't tell anybody. Pretty straightforward, regular joists and scantlings, nothing too exotic beyond this cone roof, trying to accommodate the tall one, spacing the collar beam so he won't thump his head when he stands up, though they'll be spending most of their time either sitting or upon their backs." "Oh, now, Clovis, your bride is safe. 'Tis the only way for them to look straight up at the stars that pass high overhead, these being the best for the latitude, as they say." "Aye, and that great telescope tube thing ever pointing straight up? Hey, why's it got to be that big?" "Don't break your rhythm, Hobab. I was quite enjoying it. The gents wish to measure this quite closely, find and keep the latitude of their line to fractions of a second of arc. The tube being the radius of the limb, see, a longer tube will swing you a bigger arc. Longer limb, longer divisions, more room between the markings, easier reading, nicer reading." Mr. Chu appears to be making a speech. "Shall we stop hammering till he's done?" Hobab inquires. "Other questions arise," Mr. Loxley gazing into the distance. "Your notion of futurity. Shall we continue to need contracts with these people? How soon do you expect our Savior's return may render them void? Considerations like that." I say, whenever you can, give them all a 21-hammer salute, growls Clovis. I say, take their money. We don't have to love them, says Hobab. Or even marry him, adds young Elijah, the swamper. Here are the astronomers, Mr. Loxley notes. Perhaps you'd like to share some of your analysis with them. God grant ye clear skies, gentlemen, shouting over the newly percussive activity of his crew. Dixon, removing his hat, tries out the doorway, goes in, and lies supine upon the fresh-sawn planking. Looking up, he sees Clovis, spread still as a spider among the radio rafters, watching him. Ask you something, sir? What thought have you given to getting that great tube in the door? Oh, Mr. Bird calculated the whole thing years ago, over in England, all on paper. Before there was ever a scantling cut? Before there was ever a screw cut for the instrument? I'll study on it. Thank you, sir. He tips a non-existent hat and descends. Mason looks in. Will we get it in the door, Dixon? Dixon stands up carefully. This is the very same whim-wham we had at the Cape. No trouble, gents. We'll make you a door. It shall go in, promises the cheery Hobab. And out, too, adds Elijah from beneath a load of weatherboarding. Dixon, as a needleman anxious to obtain the latest magnetic intelligence of the region that awaits them, rumors reaching him of a coffee house frequented by those with an interest in the magnetic, however it be manifested, shows up one night at the Flower de Luce in Locust Street. There, over the evening, he will find among the clientele German enthusiasts, quack physicians, land surveyors, iron prospectors, and watch thieves who know how to draw a half-hunter from one pocket into another with the swiftness of a lodestone clapping a needle to its influence. Strangers greet him as they might a friend of ancient standing, whilst others, obviously seeking to shun his company, glare whenever the fumes of tobacco allow them mutual visibility. He has no idea what any of it is about. Gently tacking among the crowd, he arrives at the bar. Evening, sir. What'll it be? Half and half, please. Mount Kenya Double A with Java Highland. Perhaps a slug of boiled milk as well. Planning on some elevated discourse tonight? Jests the coffee draper, swiftly and with little misdirection assembling Dixon's order. His wig shines with a nimbus in the strange secondary light from the mirror behind him. This may seem an odd question, sir, but have I been in here before? Goodness, no. Yet how many times a day do I get asked that very thing? Different visitors with different expectations. You strike me as the English tavern sort, and so you'll be noticing there's less reserve round here than you may be used to, though any who seek a quarrel may readily find it, yea, unto dirks and pistols, if that truly be your preference. Albeit, make yourself at home, and good luck in America. Dixon beamingly adverts to the early crowd here, immediately noticing Dr. Franklin's friend, Dolly, though she's certainly not as eye-catchingly rigged out tonight as he's seen her before. Nor can he immediately spy any of her companions. Soberly consulting a large map upon a mahogany desktop, she holds a pair of silver dividers, multiply jointed, tending to white gold in the candlelight, and refers repeatedly to a book of numerical tables, now and then gracefully walking the instrument up, down, and cross its paper stage. When she looks up at last, he guesses from her eyes that she knows he's been there all the time. "Why, Mr. Dixon, well met!" Holding out her hand, and before Dixon can begin to incline to kiss it, shaking his as men do. These data arrived but this instant by the German packet, the latest declination figures. Our easterly movement in Pennsylvania, as it's been doing in latter years, decelerates yet. Here 'tis 4.5 minutes east, as Dixon attentively gazes over her shoulder, when in the year 60 was 4.6. If you head south, 'twill be 3.9 at Baltimore. Were these measured heights, he murmurs, a very precipice? What could be causing it, do you imagine? Something underground, moving westward? Hush! Her eyes rapidly sweep the vicinity. No one ever speaks of that aloud here. What sort of incautious lad are you, exactly? Why, the usual sort, I guess. Well, she pulls him into an alcove. Rather took you for an all-nations lad myself. Been there. The serving girls at the all-nations coffee house are costumed in whimsical versions of the native dress of each of the coffee-producing countries. an Arabian girl, a Mexican girl, a Javanese girl, and according to Dolly, a Sumatran girl as well. A constantly shifting pageant of allegorical coffees of the world, to some ways of thinking, in fact, quite educational, though attracting a core clientele louder, beefier, and altogether less earnest than Dixon by now expects to find in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. Sumatran, I say. You seem about to swoon, sir. He takes a delighted breath. I don't know how much of my story thou may already have heard, bringing his chair closer, or, to be fair to Mason, our story. She shifts her own chair away. You and Mr. Mason are quite close, I collect. As we get along, this is our second job together. The trick is all in staying out of each other's way, really. There are arrangements in the world, she explains, too sadly familiar to women, wherein, as we say among us, with the one you get the other as well. Lass, lass, hey, what a suggestion. We'd make that one only to our commissioners, I vouch. Unless, that is, thou'r indicating some interest in Mason. Or asking upon Molly's behalf, her eyelashes indulging in an extra bat. This gets very complicated, doesn't it? Mason does need to be out more for fair. I'm but thinking of myself here. Ever been cooped up with a melancholic for days on end? Dolly shrugs. Oh, aye, Molly Sourapple. She's lucky I don't get like that. Two of us? Forget it. I find it hard work to be cheery all the time, says Dixon, as cheery as it seems I must. Really? Tell me all, the way your face begins to ache. Here's the optimist, wagging their thumbs. Mr. Franklin must get that all the time. Mr. Franklin does not confide in me, nor would I encourage him to. He is too charming, too mysterious, entirely the wrong sort for a great philosopher. Dixon touches the end of his nose. Ow, shaking his finger back and forth. Need some filing down. Do excuse me. My tale is simple. I held my first mariner's compass when I was 9, an age when girls develop unforeseen yet passionate interests. I believed there was a ghost in the room. I walked with it then everywhere. The first thing I understood was that it did not always point north, and it was the dips and deflections I grew most curious about. In my circumferometer box, I'd learned to read what shapes lay beneath the earth, all in the needle's dance. Upon the fell, as if there were not enough already out there to bring me anxiety, I discovered my instrument acting as a cryptoscope. Into powers hidden and waiting, the needles of intruders set up as a picket to warn something within of any unannounced wishes to enter. No creatures of the fell I'd ever heard of enjoyed that much protection. Being shabby, solitary, notable more for the irrational fierceness of their desires than for any elegance or justice in the enactment of them. You'd have impressed them in Maryland, she informs him. Cecilius Calvert, or, as he is styled by some for his unreflective effusions, the silliest Calvert, though not by me, for I consider him subtle, believes you a wizard, a dowser of iron. Close attention to the instrument, a lot of backsighting, repetition, and frustration, why disenchant them? If it's weird Geordie powers they wish, why, WGPs they shall have, and plenty of them, too. Mr. Calvert offered me port in a silver cup, seemed quite merry. In most places it is termed giggling. They are geese down there. They imagine that you and your instrument will make of them nabobs, like Lord Lepton, to whose ill-reputed plantation you must be drawn upon your way west, relentlessly as the needle. Then, sailor among the iron isles, circumferenter swab, beware. Chapter 31. One morning in late December, they wake to a smell of seaweed and brine. The wind is sensibly colder. Before it swiftly run gray small clouds, more and less dark. Light, when it arrives, comes ever crosswise. Something wrong with the town this morning, Dixon mutters. And what's that god-awful twittering sound? Styled birds, I'm told. How's it possible we've never heard any here before? Dixon, hold! The hammers, the ripsaws, the meat wagons, the screaming uninterrupted. What's happened? Eh? It's been Christmas, hasn't it? One of us, Mason declares, must put on his shoes and coat and go down into that street there and discover the reason for this unsettling silence. Hey, so let's have Junior's horse in the roasting pan once again, shall we? That's Bonnie, protests Dixon. Be practical. If they kill you and I remain safe, the loss to British astronomy, if any, will go largely unnoticed. Well, put that way, of course. Where's my hat, then? Not that one, thank you, sir. No, I'll need the broad brim today. You're going out as a Quaker? Hey, he has costume advice for me now as well. He, who all too plainly exhibits his need, when in public, ever to deflect attention. Inexpensive salvo, Mason notes. Geordie intuition, then, Dixon tapping his head with the side of his thumb before pulling on a classic Philadelphia Quaker's hat, differing in little but size from thousands of others here in town. Trust mine. In London they may sift you by your shoes, but in this place 'tis hat and wig by which a man, aye, and woman too, may infallibly be known. They've been looking at my wig all this time? My hat? Dixon, you're sure? Aye, and forming opinions based upon what they saw as well. What, for example? What matter? 'Tis much too late. They've all made up their minds about thee by now. Then I'll wear something else. So then they'll be on about that. Aye, there he is, old look before you leap. He, bold enough to clap on anything as stylish as the Adonis? No, 'tis but the tried and true, for old heavens, what'll they think of me? What, my wig, it isn't adventurous enough, you're saying? Attend me, man. Molly and Dolly, remember them, discuss little but thy appearance and ways to modify it, at least in my hearing, ruining, alas, and more than once, the promise of a sparkish evening. Thy wig in particular provoking one of the greatest, forgive me, of all thy failures of attention. It's a Ramillies of the middling sort, bought some years ago since of a fugitive Irish wig maker at Bermondsey, styled himself Mr. Larry whilst ye tarry, with nothing remarkable at all about it. You say you've been spending time with... Time and coin and little else. Aye, but that's another tale, tis not? With all my reconnaissance mission awaits, and dammy, I'm off. And he is, Mason following so closely as nearly to have his nose caught in the jam. Wait, I was going out with ye. Hopping down the stairs into his shoes, attempting to button his jacket, how are you fitting that in among all the obs and social visits? Fitting what in? Dixon staring in comic dismay down toward his penis as he has seen marketplace drolls do. The snow this morning is ankle deep, crepitous, with more on the way. The street before the inn seems deserted. Odd for Wednesday market. 'Tis another damned preacher, Mason opines, who's magnetized the whole population away to a tent someplace. You know how they are here. Flock to anything, won't they, worldly Philadelphians? The nearest coffee house, the Restless Bee, lies but a block and a half distant. There, if any place, should be news up to the minute. On the way over, they begin at last to hear ship's bells and bosun's pipes from the docks, children out coasting, dogs barking, a teamster with a laden wagon in a snowdrift, and presently, indeed, the crescent drone and susurrus of assembly. Directly in front of the Restless Bee, they come upon a circle of citizens, observing, and in some cases wagering upon, a furious struggle between two men. One, to appearance, a city Quaker, whose hat has been knocked off, the other, an apparent Presbyterian from the back country, dressed in animal hides from head to foot, each having already taken a number of solid blows from the other, neither showing any lapse of pugnacity. "Excuse me, sir," Mason inquires of a gentleman in full wig, velvet coat and breeches, and carrying a lawyer's bag, "what is the matter here?" The attorney, after staring at them for a bit, introduces himself as Mr. Chantry. "You're from well out of town, if you've not heard the news." "Eh?" Dixon's eyes seeking the zenith. "At Lancaster, day before yesterday, the Indians that were taking refuge in the jail there were massacred every one by local irregulars, the same band that slew the other Indians at Conestoga but week before last." "So finishing what they'd begun," contributes an aproned mechanic nearby. "Now the entire tribe is gone, the lot." "Were there no soldiers to prevent it?" Dixon asks. Colonel Robertson and his regiment of Highlanders refused to stir, toasting their noses whilst that brave Paxton vermin murdered old people, small children, and defenseless drunkards, not being men enough to face warriors in a real fight. Mind your speech, friend, or 'tis your hat'll be on the ground as well, and your head in it. And here's to Matt Smith and Reverend Stewart. Here's death to 'em, the cowardly dogs. Further insults, then snowballs, fists, and brickbats begin to fly. This way, gentlemen, Mr. Chantrey helpfully steering the surveyors to the alley and through a back entry into the coffee house, where they find tumult easily outroaring what prevails outside. With its own fuliginous weather, at once public and private, created of smoke billowing from pipes, hearths, and stoves, the room would provide an extraordinary sight, were any able to see, in this combination, peculiar and precise, of unceasing talk and low visibility, that makes riot's indoor sister, conspiracy, not only possible, but resultful as well. One may be inches from a neighbor, yet both blurred past recognizing. Thus may advice grow reckless and prophecy extreme, giving the astonishing volume of words moving about in here, not only aloud but upon paper as well, paper being waved in the air, poked at repeatedly for emphasis, held up as shielding against uncongenial remarks. Here and there in the nebulosity, lone lamps may be made out at undefined distances, snugly haloed, servant boys moving to and fro, house cats in warm currents of flesh running invisibly before them, each boy vigorously working his small bellows to clear a path through the smoke, meantime calling out names, true and taken. Boy, didn't they tell you that name is never to be spoken aloud in this room? Ah, from somewhere in the murk. So you've sneaked in again, where your face can't be seen. I have every right, sir. Boy, clear me a pathway to that infamous voice, and we shall see. Gentlemen, gentlemen. There'll be pistol play soon enough, by the looks of this new express here, just arrived from over Susquehanna, for there's no doubt about it now. The Paxton boys are on the move. Hurrah! Shame! How many, Jephthah? 'Tis Micah, an hundred and picking up numbers by the hour. So says it here. Smokers pause in mid-puff. The communal vapors presently beginning to thin, human forms emerge in outline, some standing upon chairs and even tables, others seeking, in literal consternation, refuge beneath the furniture. The boys say they're coming for the Moravian Indians this time. Indians in Philadelphia? Dixon curiously. Mr. Chantrey explains. Converted by the Moravian Brethren years before the last French War, caught between the warring sides, distrusted by everyone, wishing only to live a Christian life, these Indians were peacefully settled up near the Lehigh when the Rangers there came after them, but a few weeks before the Conestoga murders, suspecting them of being in league with Pontiac, whose depredations were then at their full flood. Though some of these people were slain, yet most escaped, arriving at Philadelphia in November. About the time you boys did, in fact, spite of the mob at Germantown who nearly did for 'em, and now 140 souls, from Wyalusing and Wecatank and Nazareth, they're down at Province Island below the city, where the Moravians and Quakers tend them. The army, given its showing at Lancaster, being no longer trusted. The Paxtons'll kill us all, someone blubbers. Fuck 'em, they shan't have anyone here. Enough is enough. Our line had better be set no nearer than Schuylkill and the ferries there brought back, first thing. How many cannon have we in town? Mason and Dixon look at each other bleakly. Well, if I'd known 'twould be like this in America. In fact, when word arrived of the first Conestoga massacre, neither astronomer quite registered its full solemnity. The Cedar Street Observatory was up at last. Mr. Loxley and his lads were done shimming and cozening square members to circular purposes, and after 2 days of rain and snow, Mason and Dixon were taking their first obs from it. Mason did note, as peculiar, that the first mortal acts of savagery in America after their arrival should have been committed by whites against Indians. Dixon muttered, "Why, 'tis the damned butter bags all over again." They saw white brutality enough at the Cape of Good Hope. They can no better understand it now than then. Something is eluding them. Whites in both places are become the very savages of their own worst dreams, far out of measure to any provocation. Mason and Dixon have consulted with all it seems to them they safely may. Recall that there are two kinds of electricity, Dr. Franklin remarked, positive and negative. Cape Town's curse is its weather. the electric charge during the stormy season being everywhere positive, whilst in the dry season all is negative. Are you certain, Dixon, mischievously, 'tis not the other way round, that the rainy weather... Yes, yes, somewhat brusquely, whichever direction it goes, the relevant quantity here is the size of the swing between the two, that vertiginous repolarizing of the air, and perhaps the ether too, which may be affecting the very mentality of the people there. Then what's America's excuse? Dixon inquired, mild as country tea. Unfortunately, young people, recalls the Reverend, the word liberty, so unreflectively sacred to us today, was taken in those times to encompass even the darkest of men's rights, to injure whomever we might wish, unto extermination were it possible, free of royal advice or proclamation lines and such. This being, indeed and alas, one of the liberties our late war was fought to secure. Bree, on her way out of the room for a moment, turns in the doorway, shocked. What a horrid thing to say. She does not remain to press the point. At the time of Bushy Run, confides Ivesley Spark, and I have seen the very document, General Bouquet and General Gage both signed off on expenditures to replace hospital blankets used to convey the smallpox to the Indians, as they perhaps too clearly stipulated. To my knowledge, marvels Ives, this had never been attempted on the part of any modern army till then. Yes, Wicks? Mr. Leespark beaming at the Reverend, you wish to add something? You may ever speak freely here, killing Indians having long ago ceased to figure as a sensitive topic in this house. Since you put it that way, the Reverend in willed cheeriness, firstly, everyone knew about the British infection of the Indians, and no one spoke out. The Paxton boys were but implementing this same wicked policy of extermination, using rifles instead. Although, secondly, unlike our own more virtuous day, no one back then was free from sin. Quakers, as handsomely as traders of less pacific faiths, profited from the sale of weapons to the Indians, including counterfeit brown besses that blew up in the faces of their purchasers as often as felled any white settlers. Thirdly, how many more are there likely to be, inquires his brother-in-law. Apparently I must reconsider my offer. Everyone got along, declares Uncle Wicks. You can't go looking for sinners, not in an occupied city, for everyone at one time or another here was some kind of rogue, the preacher as the printer's devil, the mantua maker as the milkmaid. Even little Peggy Shippen, God bless her, outrageous flirt even at 4 or 5, skipping in and out, handing each of us flowers, whilst her father frowned one by one over our disbursements. Papa's work is making him sad, the miniature temptress explained to us. My work never makes me sad. What is your work, little girl? Asks your innocent uncle. To marry a general, she replies, sweeping back her hair, and die rich. During the occupation, having reached an even more dangerous age, she had her sights actually trained upon poor young Andre, till he had his hurricane and marched away, whereupon she sulked, though not without company, till Arnold marched in, the little Schuylkill-side Cleopatra. Am I about to be shocked? Inquires Tenebrae, re-entering. Hope not, Depew blurts quietly. Well, Depew, you've made an impression, mutters Ethelmer. Didn't mean to, I'm sure. Tenebrae surveys the pair, unpromising. She sits and bends to a patch of chevron-stitched filling. Meanwhile, Mason and Dixon, a jangle through veins and reins with caffeous humors, impatient themselves to speak, are launched upon the choppy day, attending, with what civility they may summon, the often reckless monologues of others. The true war here is between the city and the back inhabitants, the true dying done by Irish, Scots, Indians, Catholics, far from Philadelphia, as from any ear that might have understood their final words. Yet is the city selling rifles to anyone with the price, most egregiously the Indians, who desire our dissolution. The rivalry is withal useful to the British, our common enemy, who thus gain the pretext for keeping troops forever upon our land. Whilst their damned proclamation line forbids to venture there those same back inhabitants who took Ohio at great suffering from the French. These damned British, with their list of offenses growing daily, have much to answer for. Oh, I tremble that Britain should ever have to reckon with the base cowards who left Braddock to die, who will turn and flee at the stir of a feather, be it but upon some dead turkey cock. Oh, let us by no means offer offense to the scum of Hibernia, nor to the Jacobite refuse of Scotland, nor to any one of this mongrel multiplicity of mud dwellers, less civilized, indeed less human than the savages upon whom they intrude. Is he in here again? Someone, pray, kill him. Reason, reason. The Irish, sir, are schooled long and arduously in insurrection, knowing how to take a magazine or raid a convoy. Britain, though evoke she the tenderest feelings, has made it so. Thus does the lunch hour speed by. Soon there's a distinct feeling in the rooms of afternoon. Maps have been brought and spread, pigeons bearing messages dispatched from under roof peaks by expert Belgians resident here to as far away as Lancaster County. Boys old enough to handle a rifle are drilling out and back. Younger brothers are active at the next order of minitude with long sticks. Whilst down at the next, the dogs run obsessively to and fro, all round the edges, faces atwist with efforts to understand. Down the street, round the corner, into the city at large, the sailors grumble in their candleless ale hovels, the devout man of business looks ahead to an hour dedicated again to the daily question, the child trembles at the turn in the day when the ghosts shift about behind the doors, and out in the gust-beaten wilderness come the Paxton boys. Steadily on they ride, relaxed, in poise, rifles athwart, the dreaded Paxton boys. With hunter's eyes and ancient wrongs a-ranklin', they soon come vis-a-vis with Mr. Franklin, whose gaze behind empurpled lenses hidden cannot be seen and so may not be bidden. Talks the siege of Philadelphia, or Attila turned anew. 'Tis too cloudy for obs tonight. Mason frets at the delay. As soon as they shall have taken measurements enough to yield trustworthy mean values of the zenith distances of Algol, Marfak, Capella, and other latitude stars, allowing them at last to compute the exact latitude of the southernmost point of Philadelphia, they can pack up and go looking for the next observatory site, some place in that same latitude to the west of here. Can't be too soon for me, Mason mutters. They are returning to their rooms from the observatory. Tavern music and hoofbeats racket upon the brick, often for blocks. I was hoping we'd yet be in town when those boys ride in, Dixon all but sighs. Why, the worst sort of Celtic degenerates? Their ancestors ate human flesh, as their relatives continue to, no doubt. They've tasted blood, they'll shoot at anything, especially targets of bright color which fail to blend enough with the environment. No, the best thing for this party to do is not dawdle, but simply get on with our work. Basically, get out of this place and, if possible, lose the red coat. Mason, reflect. As we must go west, into the forks of Brandywine, and as these barbarians of thine are advancing to the east, we are likely to meet them well before anyone in Philadelphia does. Mason frowns. Yet, suppose we kept ever 15 miles to the south. Any roads we'd have to cross leading up from the south, not down from Harris's Ferry. The main body then ought to pass by to the north of us. Unless they've rangers out, maybe even looking for us, wistfully. Then you'd have your adventure after all, though why should they bother? Dunno. Happen we're particularly the intruders they can't abide. What must we look like? A sizable band of armed pioneers working for the proprietors? Mystical machinery they've never seen? Up far too late at night, gazing at the heavens. Why, what would thee think, were it reversed? Mightn't someone explain to them? We'd have to draw within earshot first. If tales I hear of their rifles be true, why, those German gunsmiths out there know how to send a ball through a pretzel, any loop thou fancy, from a mile away. You seem curiously merry at the prospect. Merrily curious, rather, as to who commands them. Shall they really come against their mother city? Is this what America's going to be like? How, as a Quaker born, can I feel toward them any sentiments but those of grievous offense? Yet how, as a child of the 45, can my heart fail to break for the lives they've been obliged to live, and such inquiries along that line? They are just passing the door of the Restless Bee Coffee House, one of those remaining active all night, and as little able to resist the sounds of company as to pass nose numb before the perfumes of Celebes, they enter the mid-watch disputancy. Now then, Mason's Fizz presently wreathed in Delphic vapors. That's, if you'll excuse me, countermarching a bit, the 45. What would you possibly know, let alone remember, pray, of that fateful year? You were a child, out there in a pit cabin, with naught but spoil heaps to look at. Missing it all was the tale you told me, lad. Arr, arr. The blithe piping of youth, ever claiming a part in history. I love it. Somehow, another fervent cup is in his hand, from which he sips at length before singing. When night was day, and day was night, who then was the Jacobite? Of course you were far, far too young to appreciate those grand days of 45 and 6, all too electrical with passion. Thee, Mason, a Jacobite? Anyone who was 17 that summer, young Dixon, was a Jacobite. Dixon does recall a band of riders, cloaked and masked, who clambered into Raby in the middle of the night. I was watching from a pantry window down at fetlock level. Boots, the hems of cloaks, tartan patterns flashing everywhere, though the colors in that light were uncertain. Even now I believe that it was he. I could feel something of such moment, such high purpose. I knelt transfixed. I would have done whatever he bade me. It was the only time in my life I have felt that surrender to power upon which, as I have learned after to my sorrow, all government is founded. Never again. No more a maiden as to thy, and thank ye all the same. How so? He and his forces came and went upon quite the other side of England, the Irish side, most convenient to French transport. And yet, could our wishes have brought him? Well, our wishes, however little I have to expect from my own, yet am I not grown quite so melancholic as to in any way question those of others. Thoughtful of thee, Mason. 'Twas ever sunrise, Dixon, in those times. I recall less well the nights, each morning bringing us in fresh news, sightings of him everywhere. We chose to loiter near the houses with pine trees by 'em, such being a coded welcome to any Jacobite on the run as a sign of food and shelter within. In Durham, sometimes when the wind was fair, we could hear the bagpipes far away. We had never heard music like it before. Some lads, aye, and lasses, would travel miles to hear it. I didn't much fancy it, sad to say, much too predatory, less accountable for how it sounded, less human, the ever-inflated bag allowing the player to decouple song from breath. It never paused for breath. Can you imagine how unsettling that may have been? Not as a wild creature in the night, for every beast must roar, yet draw breath. Whilst this comes swelling, invisible, resistless. Something that has passed beyond the need for breath. I remember 'twas how Wolf's men came to Stroud, without bagpipes at the van, playing that music forbidden to all other Scots to play since 1745, and thereby doubly damned. A chaunting and a keening all their loss, failure, hatred, may I say, of England, frightening village after village into submission. The Brits would never have prevailed in India. In their spoliation of Scotland, they had learned the power of that cry that never breathes, the direct appeal to animal terror, and converted it to their uses, leaving loincloths besmeared all up and down the tropical world. And here were they, as those for whom they marched, doing the same to the veil of my birth and blood. The clothiers had made of children my age red Indians, spying upon them from the woodlands they thought were theirs. We called them the white people, and the house they lived in, the big house. Splendid boyhood, you might say, but you'd be wrong. What I had imagined a paradise proving instead but the brightly illustrated front of the arras, behind which all manner of fools lay bleeding, and real rats swarmed, their tails undulating, waiting their moment. I discovered the rulers who did not live in castles, but in housing less distinct, often unable to remain past earshot of the engines they own and draw their power from. Imagine you're out late on a spring night, riding along with your sweetheart, an evening trembling with promise. All the night an Eden. Should we be discussing this? Yes, because all at once one has blundered sheep-eyed upon yet one more bloody mill, a river turned to a race, the works lit up in the dark like a great hostelry full of ill-humored elves. Any chances for a few sentimental hours nipped, as ever in Gloucestershire, as soon as they may arise. You, simple Geordie, inhabit a part of England where ancient creatures may yet move in the dusk, and the animals fly, and the dead pop in now and then for coffee and a chat. Upon my home soil, the ground for growing any such wonders has been cruelly poisoned. With the coming of the hydraulic looms and the appearance of new sorts of wealthy individual, the late-come rulers upon whom, as a younger person, I spied, silent, whilst holding savage feelings within. I was expelled from paradise by Wolfe and his regiment. One penetration and no withdrawal could ever have meaning. My home's no more. Does Dixon catch an incompletely suppressed lilt of insincerity? Something's askew. Thou art in exile, then. With London but the first station, then came the Cape, then St. Helena, now these provinces. You were there and are here. You must have seen it, each time, another step further. Away? Away from? Perhaps not away, Dixon. No, perhaps toward. Hadn't considered that, hey? Optimism. Exercise your boobyish casuistry upon that, why don't you? Toward what? I, the booby? I? When, indeed? But how much further upfield can he bring that before a brush from one of Rebecca's potent wings? Toward what, then? Yet in the tone of a fop to a bedlamite, concealing the demand, amuse me. Chapter 32. And they proceeded to trade blows, cries Pitt. Hurrah, adds Pliny. They'd roll over and over, smashed the furniture, Mason got a black eye, and Dixon a bloody nose. And the others came running, their coins a jingle, some pass bank bully hastily recording their wagers upon narrow scraps of elephant. Lomax, chides Yuffie. Boys, their parents call, bedtime. Us to bed? Queries Pitt. Who should be listening to a tale of geminity, explains Pliny, if not twins? Your surveyors were twins, were they not, uncle? Up to a point, my barking fire dogs, the reverend having thought it over, as it seemed to me that Mason and Dixon had been converging to all but a semblance, till something occurred between them in 67 or 68 that divided their destinies irremediably. Separated them? Cried the twins. Perhaps this would be a good moment for us to abandon the narrative, says Pitt. Best to remember them just this way, agrees Pliny, before an inch of that line was ever drawn. Bedtime for bookends, calls their sister. The express packet Goose Down is whistling all non-children ashore, back to their storm-wrecked jetty, back to their gray, unpromising port town. There to bide far into the night, exiles from the land their children journey to and through so effortlessly. What about Indians? Asks Pitt, adhering to the door jamb. You did mention Indians, mutters Pliny around his brother's shoulder. Do the surveyors get to fight anyone, at least? Anyone killed? A frigate battle isn't enough for you parlor apes, the reverend smiting himself upon the cheeks in dismay. Pontiac's conspiracy, Pitt, hopefully. Broken, alas, whilst the surveyors were in Delaware, running the infamous tangent line with its consort of correctional segments. The Paxton boys? No likelier. Whilst they rode whooping and shooting upon Philadelphia, the surveyors were out in the forks of Brandywine, well south of the invasion route, with a new observatory up and the stars nimbly hopping the wires for them, as they gazed from some place here upon Earth's surface, yet in their thoughts how unmappable. May we have Indians tomorrow, uncle? Of course, Pitt. Plenty, sir. The younger. Off they go. Tenebry, now the youngest of the company, brings in fresh candles and fills the tea kettle and puts it upon the hearth. Depew and Thelmer observe her covertly as she moves, seemingly unaware of the effect her flexed nape, her naked ear swiftly reconcealed by a shaken tress, her hands in the firelight, are having upon them. If Mason's elaborate tales are a way for him to be true to the sorrows of his own history, the Reverend Cherrycoke presently resumes, a way of keeping them safe and never betraying them, in particular those belonging to Rebecca, then Dixon's tales, the Emersoniana, the ghosts of Raby, seem to arise from simple practical matiness. Who, if not Mason, at any given moment needs cheering? A cheerful party chief means a cheerful party. Directly before the Falmouth packet sailed, he begins one night as they wait for a star, William Emerson presented me with a small mysterious package. "'Twill not be an easy journey," quoth he. "'There'll be days when the compasses run quaquaversely wild, "'boxing themselves and you into perplexity. "'Or happen the stars be absented for fortnights at a time, "'with your own pulse, as ever, a suite of changing tempi. "'Then will a reliable ticker come in handy. "'This one, as you see, is too tarnished and wounded "'for any British or French thief to consider worth an effort.' Yet, Americans being less sophisticated, I'm obliged, Jeremiah, to enjoin ye, be vigilant to the point of folly, if folly it takes, in your care of this watch. For within it lies a secret mechanism that will revolutionize the world of horology. Hey, calculates when she's overcharging, and by how much, something like that. What it does do, Plutonian, Emerson told him patiently, is never stop. Why, aye, and upon the hour it sings Yankee Doodle? You'll see, 'tis all in the design of the remontoire. The first thing an Emerson pupil learns is that there is no perpetual motion, said Dixon, which I am, in fact, all these years later still upset about, sir, perhaps in some strange way holding thee responsible. What are we to do? 'Tis a law of the universe, prandium gratis non est. Nonetheless, if we accept the theorem hand and key are to mainspring, as clock train is to remontoire, then the solution ever depends upon removing time rates from questions of storing power. With the proper deployment of spring constants and magnetical gating, power may be borrowed as needed against repayment dates deferrable indefinitely. Sir, why would thee entrust to me anything so valuable in so unruly a country? If it got into the wrong pocket... If anyone tries to disassemble it to see how it works, upon the loosening of a certain unavoidable screw, the entire contraption will fly apart into a million pieces, and the secret is preserved. But the watch? Oh, another's easily built. The trick's uncommonly simple, once you've the hang of it. Then why aren't these everywhere? If we are arrived in the age of Newton transcended, perpetual motion commonplace, why is it yet a secret? Interest, chuckled Emerson cryptically. In fact, compound interest. Now, what seems odd to Dixon is that 10 years ago, in Mechanics or the Doctrine of Motion, Emerson expressed himself clearly and pessimistically as to any hopes of building a watch that might ever keep time at sea, whose 10,000 irregular motions would defeat the regularity of any timepiece, whether spring or pendulum driven. Why ever, then, this dubious loan of a timekeeper even less hopeful? Their history in Durham together has been one of many such messages, not necessarily clear or even verbal, which Dixon keeps failing to understand. He knows, to the eye-blink, how implausible Emerson is as the source of the watch, meaning he is an intermediary. For whom? Who in the world possesses the advanced arts and enjoys the liberal funding required for the building of such an instrument, eh? Who, indeed? On the Falmouth packet, coming over, alone with the enigma at last, he inspects it at length, but is unable to find any provision for winding it. Yet one must be hidden someplace. Damme, he mutters into the wind, down from Blackhead, 'tis popish plots again, thick as mushrooms round the grave of merriment. Here they are, these jezzies, being expelled from one kingdom after another. Whence any spare time to devote to expensive toys like this? He is a Newtonian. He wants all loans of energy paid back, and every equation in balance. Perpetual motion is a direct affront. If this watch be a message, why, it does not seem a kind one. At last, red-eyed, and by now as anxiously seeking, as seeking to avoid any proof, he delivers the watch to Captain Falconer for safekeeping inside the ship's strongbox till the end of the voyage. Finding the timepiece upon arrival in Philadelphia, ticking away briskly as ever, and the counter-rhythms of the remontoire falling precisely as the steps of a Spanish dancer. He hopes it might be confiding to him, that its effect of perfect fidelity, like that of a clever woman, is an elaborate and careful illusion and no more, to be believed in at his peril. Like to listen, Dixon offers one day when he and Mason are out upon the tangent line. It's all right, I believe you, Mason's eyebrows bouncing up and down politely. Mason, it's true, I never have to wind it. Do you ever see me winding it? Mason shrugs. You might be winding it while I'm asleep, or when screened, as we so often are, from one the other, by trees, you might be engaging one of these rustics, keeping well out of my sight, to wind it regularly. Do I have to go on? Friend, would I quiz with you upon something this serious? All our assumptions about the conservation of energy, the Principia, eh? Our very faith as modern men, suddenly in question like that? Had I tuppence for every approach made to Bradley upon the topic of perpetual motion, I should be elsewhere than this. Recumbent, I imagine, upon some sand beach of the Friendly Isles, strumming my ukulele and attended by local maidens, whom I may even sometimes allow to strum it for me. Eh, you are fair suspicious. Listen to it, at least. Watch to his ear, frown growing playful, Mason after a bit begins to sing. Ay, senorita, it can't be sweeter. What shall we do? What a fiesta. Not much siesta. Do you think so, too? Look ye, the moon is ascending. You no comprehending, Glace. It's just as well, for I'm in your spell. What's that, can't you tell? Ay, senorita. Yes, amusing little rhythm device. Not loud enough for ensemble work, of course. Forgive me, friend. I've again presumed our minds running before the same wind. My deep error. Mason, in reply, begins to wag his head, as at some unfortunate event in the street, whilst Dixon's annoyed. Do thou fancy I've an easy time of it? With the evidence before me, gathering each day I don't wind the blasted watch? Even so, I can't believe in it. I know thou old man's idea of merriment. I am thrown into a vortex of doubts. The watch ticks complexly on. To Dixon, sworn not to let it out of his sight, a burden whose weight increases with each non-torsionary day. At last, at some station ankle-deep in a classically awful lower county's bog, he is able to face the possibility he's been cursed. Emerson, long adept at curses, having found himself, he once confessed to Dixon, using the gift, as he grows older, in the service less of blunt and hot-headed revenge than of elaborate and mirthful sport, directed at any he imagines have wronged him. Has Dixon finally made this list? Did he one day cross some line, perhaps during a conversation he's forgotten, but Emerson has ever since been brooding upon, perhaps in detail? Eh, everyone's nightmare in these times. An unremembered slight, avenged with no warning. What did I do, confronting his teacher at last in a dream, to merit such harsh reprisal? Had I been that wicked to thee, I'd surely remember. You violated your contract, Emerson producing a sheaf of legal paper, each page embossed with some intricate seal, which, if not read properly, will bring consequences Dixon cannot voice, but whose terror he knows. Where would you like to begin, Plutonian? 'Tis now Dixon recalls the advice given Mason at the Cape by the Negrito Toko, ever vigorously to engage an enemy who appears in a dream. He knows that to be drawn into Emerson's proposed exercise is to fight at a fatal disadvantage upon his enemy's ground. His only course is to destroy the document at once, by fire preferably, though the nearest hearth is in the next room, too far to seize the papers and run with them. Emerson is reading his thoughts. Lo, a fire sign who cannot make fire. The contempt is overwhelming. Dixon feels defeat rise up around him. It seems the watch wishes to speak, but it only struggles with the paralyzed voice of the troubled dreamer. Nonetheless, Dixon's salvation lies in understanding the message. Whereupon he awakes, feeling cross. Though sworn to guarantee the watch's safety, he soon finds his only thoughts are of ways to rid himself of it. In its daylit ticking, the voice so clogged and cryptic in his dream has begun to grow clearer. Drinking will not send it away. When you accept me into your life, whispering as it assumes a shape that slowly grows indisputably vegetable, as it lies within its open traveling case of counterfeit chagrin, glimmering, yes, a sinister vegetable he cannot name, nor perhaps even great Linnaeus, its surface meanwhile passing through a number of pleasing colors as its implied commands are delivered percussively, fatally, you will accept me into your stomach. A tremble, and fizz far from ruddy, he shows up at the tent of the camp naturalist, Professor Vohm, who advises that, as the fate of vegetables is to be eaten, as success and reputation in the vegetable realm must hence be measured by how many are eaten, it behooves each kind of vegetable to look as appetizing as possible, doesn't it? Or risk dying where it grew, not to mention having then to lie there listening to the obloquy and complaint of its neighbors. But dear me, as to objects of artifice, watches and so forth, tell me, with all honesty, sir, regarding this watch, does it not seek to project an appearance not only appetizing, but also, I can't say it. Vegetables don't tick, the professor gently reminds Dixon. Why, I, those that be only vegetables don't. We speak now of a higher form of life, a vegetable with a pulse beat. Beyond me, try asking R.C. He enjoys puzzles. Beyond R.C., a local land surveyor employed upon the tangent enigma, as well, though he's not about to say so. From the instant he sees the watch, the mens rea is upon him. He covets it. He dreams of it, never calling it the watch, but the chronometer. In his mind, conflating it with the marvelous timepiece of Mr. Harrison, thus flexibly has the story reached America of the rivalry between the Harrisons and Maskelyne to secure the longitude, and as much prize money as may be had from longitude's board. If a man had a chronometer such as this, R.C. asks Dixon, mightn't it be worth something to those gentlemen? A tight-fisted bunch, according to Mason, thou must open their grip upon it with a prying bar. Must be why they call it prize money, says R.C. I'll bet you find it tempting, though, don't ye? I'm not sure whose this is, Dixon replies carefully. I'm keeping it for someone. A gratuitous bailment, of course. R.C. trying his best not to look mean. As a transit fellow, Dixon recognizes R.C.'s complaint but too well. The many years passed among combatants, unremitting, unable by one's honor to take sides however much over the brim emotions might run, assaulted soon or late by all parties, falling at last into a moral stuporousness as to the claims of law. In fact, perilously close oneself to being mistaken for a lawyer. A bonny gone-on. Did you see that, boys? Good enough to eat. Axemanly wit at the watch's expense causes R.C. to glower and approach, often to fractions of an inch away. What are you in my fizz for now, R.C.? You don't want to be offending the wrong folks, R.C. advises,